Welcome, science enthusiasts and tech aficionados. Today we're going back in time to explore the sophisticated world of ancient Japanese technology and science. Imagine a realm where technology harmonizes with nature and innovation springs from the necessity and respect for the environment. We're going to uncover the secrets possibly behind the bamboo water wheels and maybe have some time for some water clocks. So join us together as we traipse through ancient Japan again. I'm your host, Mitchell. I am joined by the whoop whoop. You didn't hear that. That's just the disassociation in the background. But I am joined by Tom. How's it going, Tom?
Hello. Yeah, it's going good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. Doing good.
Good. Good.
That's what it is. Glad to hear it. Life's throw me curveballs and I'm just missing every one of them, but I'm still playing the game, which is all that matters.
You're not out yet.
I'm not out yet. Not quite. If you could follow us on the social media platform of your choosing, the one that you use the most. I don't know which one that is. Like you may use X or Twitter or Facebook, wherever it is. Google us, search us, find us. We're the same name everywhere. You'll find us in the search bar. It's all good. Right, Tom.
Hi.
How's it going?
Oh, it's going good, mate. Yeah. Went to see Hamilton last night.
Alexander Hamilton. Was that in Edinburgh?
Yeah, it was in Edinburgh.
Yeah, someone I work with went on Wednesday. Oh. Have you seen it before? As in, like, watched it?
We were
on
at
Disney.
The same place then, at the same time.
Oh, okay.
Because yesterday, for those of you listening in the future, for us is Wednesday.
I meant last week. Apologies.
Oh, I see.
That was on me not being specific enough.
No, I had managed to avoid all of the music. I hadn't watched it anywhere. So it was completely new experience. Like, I just had no idea what I was going into. Apart from en route, they were like, oh, I can't wait for the rapping. And I was like, there's going to be rapping? Hashtag spoilers. For those of you who haven't seen it yet.
I don't think that is a spoiler.
No, it wasn't much of a spoiler. But it was like, just, yeah, incredible. It was really, really good. Would highly recommend.
One of my favorite musicals. Would advise anybody that enjoys a good musical to go and watch it. It's on Disney Plus. I've watched it about 10 times on Disney Plus. It's on my Spotify. I've probably listened to it 20, 30 times on my Spotify.
It leaves Edinburgh on the 27th. So I don't know where they go on tour after that. So, but it's not Edinburgh. So if you're looking for that, the boat on that has probably sailed.
Sail away. Yeah,
yeah, I think I'll watch it on Disney at some point just to re-solidify the story.
Because yes, also,
a lot of the lyricism is quite fast.
Lin-Manuel's is also the best version of enjoying it.
I can imagine. Is that the one on Disney, is it?
Yes.
It was just a straight from the first Broadway stint.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I think it'll be... wow. Just forgot how to speak there. Yes, I'll watch that. Nice. Anyway, enough about my life. We're here to speak about science and just chat a lot of bollocks. So I got some news of the week. Now, news we have this this like thing on the show where sometimes we cover a topic and then significant advances are made in that topic just after we produce the show. And I'm sure that's just frequency bias and things like that. But a very quick side note, Egypt got back one of their statues of Pharaoh Ramses II. After 30 years, it had been taken out of the country 30 years ago by the British, obviously. And it went on sale in London because they were like, oh, we don't want this anymore. We'll sell it. And the Egyptians were like, oh, can we just have that back, please? And obviously they said no because, I don't know, they're white or something. It made its way to Switzerland before being returned back to Egypt today. So quick little side note whilst we're on the ancient and historical episodes. However, the groundbreaking news, at least which I found this week, is a discovery of a new or first ever known structure in complex cells that's capable of drawing nitrogen from the atmosphere and converting it into a form of energy that cells can use. Now, they've dubbed this what they call the nitroplast. And according to recent studies, which have been investigating this for a long time, we think it evolved 100 million years ago. But this is the only the fourth time it's ever happened in the history of life on Earth that we know of.
Okay, yeah.
So the essentially, what's happened here is you have a eukaryotic cell which has swallowed a prokaryotic cell which has no nucleus. And instead of that cell, instead of the eukaryotic cell digesting that cell, it instead just kept it inside because it was producing something that was useful to it, and then it became an organelle, an organ, let's say. It would be the equivalent of us, I don't know, eating a plant, and then it's gone, ah, this produces food for us just by being in the sunlight, so we're going to keep these plants inside of us. And in fact, that is how plants evolve. They were prokaryotic cells, and you had chloroplasts, which turn sunlight into sugars, free-floating organisms. The chloroplasts at some point were swallowed up by a eukaryotic cell, and instead of killing it and digesting it, it went, oh, actually, if I give you a home, I'll just eat the sugars that you release. And there we had plants. So, yeah. So they said, this is the first time we think it... The first time we think it happened, it gave rise to all complex life. So that was the evolution of the mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell. A similar thing, process, happened there. A eukaryotic cell with a nucleus swallowed up another prokaryotic cell and went, actually, the byproducts you're producing are quite useful. So if I feed you things and I take the outputs, then I have to work a lot less harder. That wasn't English. I have to work less harder, less hard, to get the nutrients and things that I need. So that happened 1.5 billion years ago, leading to mitochondria and all complex animal cells. It happened a long time ago, and it created plants. And now we found it, we think it evolved around 100 million years ago, in a algal cell that can now, well, it could do it anyway, an algal cell that can take up nitrogen and turn that into usable energy. And this is such a big thing because, one, it's the first time, the fourth time we've ever known this to happen in the history of the Earth. And two, hopefully nitrogen fixing is such an issue, especially in agriculture and just lots of different areas of research as well. So being able to maybe harness this energy and this algae in particular and just, you know, nitrogen fix a lot of things. It can potentially turn agriculture around in a lot of countries, and also just gives us an opportunity to study some recent evolution as well. So pretty cool. Pretty cool. Exciting things in the world of biology. So yeah. The only other time this thought to have happened, by the way, we've spoken about this before when speaking about octopuses and chameleons, is the chromatophore, how they can change color. It's thought that that evolved in the same way as well.
Wow, mystical arts that people don't realize what just happened. Technical issues that have been smoothed over in an instant.
Whoop, whoop.
Tom was just talking about some absolutely crazy stuff to do with plants and ingesting. You know what?
You know, almost through two mics at the same time.
Yeah.
So if there is some weird artifacting going on,
yeah.
Hopefully you didn't hear that, so no worries.
Yes. But you were hearing Tom twice, which I'm not sure if anybody really needs Tom twice.
Yeah, wow.
Apologies, Tom.
Cool. Okay.
So this is episode 2 of Ancient Japan.
Yes.
Last week we covered... I went into Japanese ink a bit too aggressively. And hopefully you all went out and had a look at that video and watched it and was in amazement, just like I was, about how difficult and how long it produced, time it takes to produce Japanese ink. We also talked about the art of steel folding and how the sort of scientific effect of that and how that works. And what sort of advantage it provides to their weaponry and any other sort of metal they use for their katanas. It's all to do with the carbon being layered in a specific kind of way. The carbon,
yeah.
It's all about the carbon. We also went into a lot about the history, ancient history of Japan, the different eras, all that kind of good stuff. So if you've missed
earthquake resistant architecture as well. Some shaky. Good stuff there. So go check it out.
I don't know why I did talk about that last week. ITER, which is the liquid fluoride reactor. No, it's not. Is it that one? No, it's the plasma one. The one in south of France. The liquid fluoride thorium reactor. They've got my dad took photos when he was there and it was being built. But like the magnets that they sit on for, like if an earthquake does happen, like to allow it to shift round to a certain extent.
That's cool.
Yeah. He was like, take a photo of him as just like pointing at it.
And
a lot of it was like, look at this rebar. Look at this rebar. Look at this rebar in cement. I'm like, okay, cool. But there was some cool stuff there going on. But yes, so ancient Japan to the electric boogaloo. I think the last thing we could speak about, unless you want to dive into something straight off the bat. You got something you want to chat?
I'm intrigued.
Well, why are you saying no as a question mark?
Because you were like, the last thing we said we couldn't speak about, unless you want... So I'm intrigued what that means.
Okay, we ran out of time. That's what I'm saying.
We started
talking about water clocks.
We did. Yes.
Yes.
I don't have anything on that, mate. So this is all you.
Oh, you do not have anything about water clocks?
No, I have a bit about...
science tech.
Time and how the different time system that they had. But,
okay. I'll talk about the sort of the science, cultural significance, all that sort of jazz of the water clock. The Japanese water clock, known as the Rikoku, is a historically significant timekeeping device that exemplifies the integration of practical engineering with the rhythmic natural cycles. So there were some scientific principles all around the Rikoku. I want to call it a Roku because that's the thing that we watch and have. Is it a platform that you can buy things from? Or is it the Roku device?
Oh, I was thinking of Avatar Roku from The Last Airbender.
Been chopped and changed and a lot of people use it. But the Roku operates on the Rikoku, not the Avatar Roku. You said there was a word that you were going to try and avoid doing it. I think this is mine. It operates on the principles of hydrodynamics, specifically utilizing the constant rate of water flow as a time measurement mechanism. This technology is based on the outflow water clock system, where water drips at a nearly constant rate from a controlled orifice in a water-holding vessel. This time is then measured by the amount of water that has been dripped out, typically marked by graduations inside the container that indicates time intervals. These clocks leverage the physical properties of water, such as viscosity and density, which can be affected by temperature and impurities. Therefore, the design of the Rikoku often included features to minimize the influences to maintain accuracy. For example, the water container's materials and the orifice's shape and size were critical design elements that ensured a steady flow rate.
What's not there is they...
What did they compare it to? This is like, how did they come up with the first one?
But also, they had the ability to be like, oh, this one's running a bit slow. And it's because of the temperature.
Yes.
Like, that's nuts.
Well, if it was a sealed temperature, if the temperature went up, surely it would run fast.
Well, I wasn't doing it like actual examples, because I don't know.
Podcast, Tom. And
okay, yeah. Everyone knows that's my specialty, water flow.
Water dynamics.
That's mad. I mean, the only sense I would have there is be like, oh, it's cold, it's frozen, time stopped.
That's
as much as I would have the wherewithal there. But the fact that they just had the ability to notice those differences is mad.
Mm-hmm. So
very cool.
Some of the historical development and adaptations. It was originally inspired by similar technologies that came from China and Korea at the time. The Japanese adaptation of the water clock began in the 7th century, which is, I can't remember which period that was from the last episode, but they were vital for various ceremonies and administrative activities, especially in a religious context where precise timing was crucial for them. As Japanese engagements with neighboring cultures grew, so did the complexity of the and precision of the Rikoku. By the Heian period, which was 794 to 1185 Common Era, the clocks had evolved into sophisticated instruments that not only measured time, but could also became a symbol of divine continuity in Shinto and Buddhist rituals. The Rokoku were adapted to a unique Japanese time system that divided the day into unequal temporal hours, which varied with the seasons. This is what you're going to talk about this in a second, aren't you?
A little bit, but do not worry to step on my toes. I wasn't really going to go into this, so you go for it.
So this system required a flexible approach on time management, where the length of an hour changed throughout the year. The mechanisms and variations of the clock. The Rokoku were primarily outflow clocks, but there were variations in their mechanism to accommodate the unequal hours of the Japanese temporal system. Some advanced designs included adjustable scales or movable markers that allowed the user to recalibrate the clock according to the seasonal variations in day and night lengths. These features were crucial for maintaining the relevance and functionality of the Rokoku throughout the year. So you'd own one that you can change and not 20 for whatever season it is.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it's sunny, get the spring clock out.
Yeah, or it's a bit warm, get the summer clock.
Yeah. But yeah, it was a really cool system, actually, that they divided it into 12, the day into 12 segments. And each of those segments corresponded to the 12 animals of the East Asian zodiac.
That makes sense.
Yes. But then, as you say, yeah, so they had 6 for nighttime, let's say, and 6 for daytime, but depending on the time of year, they really had to adjust that. And of course, depending if they were north or south, it's not the most... I wouldn't say it's a longitudinally challenged country.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the greatest distance. However, there still would have been a significant difference there. I mean, think about between Scotland and Cornwall, right? Still an extra hour or two of light. No, an hour of light in the day, including morning and evening. A really cool system.
Very, very cool system. Looking at some images of it now.
Avatar Roku.
Yeah, I was just looking at images of Avatar Roku and not a water clock. The way that they got it here is like it's a upside down cone that water's being poured into. So obviously the first hour is the shortest.
How do I spell this, sorry?
Rokoku, but the first O has got the hat. And I don't know how to do that on a keyboard. I don't want the keyboard shortcuts for that. Anybody else there knows how to do the hat? Is it like Alt, Ger, and then O?
I think it depends on your keyboard settings.
No. No.
Yeah. Either way, I certainly don't have that on my keyboard anywhere. But yeah, very cool. I can't find it anywhere.
What, the Rokoku water clock?
Yeah. Rokoku water
clock. Rokoku water clock. Loads of images.
Oh, that's because I was doing RI. That's because I'm stupid. This is cool. Wow.
Some that are really, really complex. Am I too complex for complex, Khan? Yeah. One that uses heat, one that uses pressure. Crazy stuff going on.
That's pretty wild.
Yes. Crazily wild. A common method that was actually used for the change over the time, instead of having the vessel a different size, was a floating marker inside the water vessel, which would sink at a rate determined by the outflow of water, and as the marker descended, it would pass by graduated markers aligned with the vessel's interior, or a rod placed in the water, each representing a different temporal hour.
Oh, that's good.
Yes.
Then you'd have to look inside, do you? That's a good one.
Yep. However, with the Meiji Restoration in the late 19th century, and the subsequent modernization of Japan, the traditional Rokoku was gradually replaced by Western mechanical clocks.
Sad.
This transition marked a significant shift in the Japanese timekeeping practices from a cyclical nature-based system to a more linear, standardized approach. Imagine going by standards. Never do that.
Wow. Deep cuts.
Yeah, deep cuts to my job. Standardization.
But yeah, it's very cool. And some of the one thing I did see is them modifying these clocks to fit the hourly system, but then also getting Western clocks over, mainly through I think Dutch and Portuguese traders, and then modifying those to originally fit their 12 segmented days. What do you call it? Cycle method. So yeah, some really interesting innovation at the time, which sadly didn't really stick around that long. But
yeah,
they tried.
More stuff. More stuff going on.
Yeah,
I'm always wondering the do you know the bamboo that would fill up then knock?
Fill up then knock.
Yeah, I guess you haven't seen it then.
No.
It's like you have it's like a water feature.
Yeah.
That pours water into a bamboo thing, and then once it fills up, it like falls over, empties,
yes.
Makes the knock sound. I always wondered if that was to do with like timekeeping.
Oh, maybe.
This is what a shishi odoshi. Shish. Yeah. Water. Oh, apparently it's just a water fan, but I always thought it was like a frighten away animals that pose a threat to agriculture, including Kakashi, cool, which is scarecrows. Now I just realized why the anime actor was called Kakashi, and the Naruku, which is clappers or Suzu, in a sense.
That's cool.
A segmented tube, usually a bamboo, pivoted on one side at a balance point. At its rest, it's heavy on one side than the other side. It normally rises, like, lays against the rock. As the water trickles, it fills up and then dumps water and then knocks it out.
That makes sense. I didn't really think they served an actual purpose, but
it makes sense that they do. But now it's just, I know it's just for scaring away small animals.
Yeah.
Be a scarer.
Staying on the topic of water.
Yeah.
What I looked at was aquaculture.
Do you say aquaculture or agriculture?
Yeah. Aquaculture.
Okay.
Not too dissimilar to agriculture.
Farming water, I see. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. No, modern day aquaculture is the farming of fish or shrimp. Or you can have like a two-way system where you both have like freshwater or even marine-based plants, but you also have fish there as well. It's a really cool like purpose of that. If you have some like vertical farming situations, then you can have fish in with that, and then they'll really like heighten the productivity of the hydroponic system as well. But essentially, aquaculture in its earliest form was something that was not necessarily born in Japan, but it's something that they adopted very early on and has a very long history there. So this was mainly used in rice paddies. So aquaculture in Japan dates back, with evidence suggesting that it began as early as the Heian period, which is 794. Perhaps it developed slightly earlier than that, but its widespread adoption was at that point. The practice arose from the need to supplement diets with reliable sources of protein and to efficiently use available water sources. So Japan, I think, quite well, you know, it just has a lot of water.
It's very wet as well. That's another thing.
Yeah. So that's why rice goes really well there. But you can't just survive off rice. Early forms of aquaculture often involved rice paddies where farmers would cultivate fish alongside the rice. This technique is known as integrated rice-fish farming, but it took advantage of the symbiotic relationship between the rice plants and the fish. So the fish would obviously excrement and pee everywhere and things like that, and the rice plants are like, oh, that's some good nutrition, and it would actually help them grow even more. So in this system, fish, at the time, it was commonly carp, were introduced to rice paddies. They helped to aerate the soil, control pests like insects and weeds, and their waste provided nutrients to the rice. It increased the overall productivity of the rice paddy and reduced the need, and currently reduces the need for fertilizers and pesticides because it's still an ongoing practice these days. Japanese agriculture utilized ponds to raise fish also. However, these are a bit more small and localized and used for households' needs, or I guess as the rise of commercial production started, it was often used in that sense as well. But koi carp originated here as well. So you'd have the farmers who'd have their carp in the rice paddies. And as some families kind of gained in notoriety, I suppose, they decided to bring their fish inside. And koi carp became were bred for their aesthetic. And it was a very popular choice for aquaculture as well due to its adaptability to many various environments. And eel was the other commonly cultivated species, also because it was used in traditional dishes like unagi. But yeah, I mean, in pre-modern Japan, this was incredibly... It was a very sustainable practice, and it allowed, as Mitch has alluded to quite a few times, their culture of living harmoniously with nature, yes. Especially before us Westerners arrived. It kind of allowed them to do that even to a further extent, and that farmers and people in rural settings were getting a lot of protein that they were otherwise missing out on before that.
Yeah, it's crazy to think, like, the areas that aren't like in, let's say, in harmony with the environment, like Tokyo and the other not Okinawa, because Okinawa's kind of like a bit of both, but the bits that are like really lean is like Western and tech and super build up are like in pockets. Like you have like this area here, like Tokyo.
Yeah.
It's like, we're not, but everywhere else, if it's like we are in harmony, they've gone for it. But I think it's quite really interesting because it's not like in the UK where it's like, we'll do whatever we want everywhere. It's like, okay, this area specific has to be a blend of harmony. And
yeah. It's Tokyo, something about keeping traditions alive and things like that, isn't it?
Yes.
They seem to be very much in that.
As we know, as Brits, we don't have traditions. We've just stolen them from other countries.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know, like having fish and chips on a Friday, that's a pretty good tradition. I don't know.
Well, sorry? Chips on a Friday?
Fish and chips on a Friday. Like, oh, seems like a good, good British
actually,
tradition.
Actually, started in Japan with their aquaculture.
There's also, I didn't realize, obviously there was other cultures. And I say, when I say cultures, I mean words ending in culture, like agriculture. Silviculture? Yes. The art and science of controlling the establishment growth, composition, health, and quality of forests and woodlands.
Oh. Yeah. What was that called, sorry?
Silviculture. S-I-L-V-I culture.
Oh.
Then you've got one that I don't think about, but horticulture.
Yeah.
Which is plants. For yep. biomass, textiles, and medicines, not for eating.
I was going to say viticulture then, but that is a board game.
No, viticulture is a thing. It's the cultivation and harvesting of grapes.
Oh, well, there we go. Oh, yes, you're right. On the subject of board games by Stonemaier Games, they just announced a new one called Vantage, which is a 1-6 player co-op roguelite board game, which I thought might be up your street.
Oh, mate, don't.
Yeah.
Don't. Open world as well. World cooperative roguelike adventure.
1,700 different cards. You pick a character, you kind of get launched in. 1,700
different cards. Crazy.
So that every time you play, it's really different. And I think the premise is you're traveling to an unexplored planet, the ship crashes, your players are then scattered around different locations on the planet, and then you've got to work to get back to each other. Yeah. Very quick premise. Not much more than that has been announced, because I think it was only announced yesterday. But early 2025, I think. So go check out Stonemaier Games. They're good friends of ours. Well, I say that.
We talked to them once.
We talked to them once.
Chilled for
the game. They made us champions of the website.
we are apiary champions.
To be fair, though, that is insanely good. I think it's like £12 for a year to be like a champion, and then you get 20% off, like everything. Yeah. Like it literally pays for itself. And first, like dibs on orders and things. So,
yeah. You know, like apiary is completely out of stock. Yeah,
is it?
Yeah, the next reprint is coming this summer.
I do think it's a fantastic game.
It is wonderful.
Unfortunately, it is the game that I played the least out of all my board games.
Really?
Yeah, just because we've had so like much else to like play, it's the one that we've got to the least.
Yeah, my least played game out of all my board games is The Darkest Dungeon, which is a roguelite board game, but I've never played it.
That's sad.
I got it when I was in Bristol, and I've never had an opportunity to play it. And weirdly, that's the one that I've got, like, comes with the most miniatures. There's a box that is like a foot by a foot, and that's the game. And then you get a second box, which is a foot by a foot, and that's all the miniatures.
Wow.
And then you get a third box, which is like a foot by, I would say, 4 or 5 inches wide. And that's another box full of miniatures. And I've just never been able to play it. It's never had the peeps all the time. Or I should really read the rules so I can be like, this is how we can play it. Yeah. Speaking of board games, to segue this into our next section. What are they made out of, Tom?
Bananas. Bamboo.
No, mate.
Wood.
For the listener, we go through what we plan on speaking about before the show starts. So Tom should know the other subject that I picked.
Wood.
No.
Am I close?
Yes.
Paper.
Yes, paper making. The traditional craft of making Japanese paper, known as washi, combines sensorial techniques with a deep understanding of natural materials and ecological processes. Is renowned for its durability, lightness, and unique textual properties, characteristics that are derived from the distinct fibers and methods used in its production. We're all about production and learning how things work. So, washi, I'm not even sure if it is washi, but that just sounds like such a Western... like
probably the intonation, which is slightly different. Washi.
No, it is washi.
Oh, okay.
It's wa, then she with an extra on there, so it's washi. Not washi, washi. Primarily made from the inner bark fibers of three specific plants. You have the Gampi, Mitsumata, and the Kozu, which is the same, essentially, it's like a mulberry tree. And each plant contributes unique qualities to the paper. So the Kozu fibers, for example, are long and strong, making them the most commonly used. The Gampi adds a natural sheen strength, despite its rarity and the challenges associated with its cultivation. And then you have the Mitsumata fibers, on the other hand, are known for their softness and are highly valued for making the fine papers like the ones used in Japanese banknotes. You don't know? Which they then That's use. Cool. Obviously, they're really incredible ink on. The harvesting of these fibers is timed to optimize their quality. So Kozu is typically harvested in late autumn and early winter when the sap has stopped flowing, which makes the fibers easier to process. The harvested branches are then steamed, stripped, and then the fibers are naturally bleached. Mitsumata and the Gambia harvest following a similar meticulous process, but the timing and specific treatment of the fibers vary to suit the characteristics of each plant. The actual making of the paper begins with the thorough cleaning and preparation of the fibers. These are then beaten to break them down into a pulp, which is then mixed with water in a large vat or whatever you've got on hand. If you're making it in your own home, I don't suppose you could. The unique aspect of the washi paper making lies in the formation of the sheets. A flexible bamboo screen known as a su is dipped into the vat and swayed gently to evenly distribute the pot. I've seen a video of this. I just realized what it is. This method known as nagizuki allows the fibers to interlock. Don't say it. In a random yet uniform manner, enhancing the paper's durability and aesthetic appeal. So there's a video of this online.
But it's like huge. It's not one person doing this, right?
Absolutely massive.
It's 20. Like,
yeah, there's 10 people on each side, and they dip it down, collect the fibers, and then like pull it up, and then they leave it there for a while, and then just peel it off, and then put it in a massive sheet.
Yeah, I was going to ask if so. I've done something similar to that. Obviously, not as as painstakingly accurate and meticulous as these people dedicate their lives to making. But I've made paper out of elephant shit once.
Look, okay, Tom, we're going to need some story behind this.
Mozambique. No, wrong. Yeah. Tanzania.
Tanzania.
I can't remember what we were doing. I think we just like got an excursion. We went to see some elephants, some orphaned elephants. And they were like, oh, we collected their poo. So do you want to make some paper out of it? And then you basically washed it down and you had like a little, basically a rectangle frame of wood that had like a mesh along it. And then you would kind of sift all the mulch into like a thin layer on it, and then you would peel that off and then put it in the sun to dry, and then we made it into like a little diary type thing. So essentially not too dissimilar from what you were describing, but on a much smaller scale.
Yeah, there are like hand ones.
Yeah.
So if you're making like an A4 piece of paper, you don't have to go for like the massive ones that they make. There is a YouTube channel called Rhinohara, which has got a video called How Traditional Japanese Washi Paper is Made, and they go through everything, and it's a wonderful, I'm not gonna get distracted by that. So the pulp, after it's then put through the, it's essentially like, not like, I want to say a sieve, very, 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 very fine sieve where it's like placed onto it. Is then laid out to dry, traditionally in the sun, which further then contributes to the paper's texture and colour. The use of pure cold water throughout the process is crucial, as any impurities can affect the quality and appearance of the final product. It's not only material for writing and printing, but it's also played a significant role in various cultural practices, from origami or shodu, which is the calligraphy, to ikiyo-e, which is the woodblock prints during the Edo period. Despite the decline in the traditional washi production due to the modernization, manufacturing costs and processes, it remains highly valued for its ecological benefits and cultural significance, which is what I absolutely love. Like, along with the ink and the woodworking, food prep, like the paper prep, they've held on to the old way of doing things. And I think it's just fantastic.
Yeah, because like that stuff's still done now. And instead of like it fading out, they just hiked up the prices and people are like, yeah, I'll pay that. It's good paper.
Yeah, like known for its good paper. Like back in the day, it would have been like nothing. But now, I'm just trying to think of like things in the UK.
Well, I imagine it would have been a luxury back then, right? The ink was madly expensive. So I guess the clientele would dictate.
I mean, there's nothing that I can think of. I don't know, horseshoes?
Glass blowing.
Yeah, definitely a thing. I think cider making down here in Devon.
Yeah, 100%.
I don't think we lost a lot of things along the way. Things got closed down. I don't know what. I'm just going to blame the Conservatives. my normal go to. Stub my toe. How could Rishi Sunak do this to me?
Bloody hell.
The paper's ability to degrade naturally and its production, which does not require cutting down trees, positions washi as a sustainable alternative in the global paper industry. So, looking for it. It was recognized by UNSECO as a intangible cultural heritage, underscoring its importance and need to preserve the knowledge and skills involved in its creation. So, you know.
Did you mean UNESCO?
Yeah, that's what I said. UNESCO.
Right. Okay. Never heard it said like that before. Okay. Just checking. No.
There's a lot of words that you've probably heard me say today that you've probably never heard them said in that way.
True.
Like, one of my favorite sayings is along the lines of, I've never heard those words said in that order before. It's been completely confused at something.
That happens to me a lot.
I've never heard those words said in that order before.
Completely. That's exciting. Bamboozled.
Yeah. Other side tangent.
Yeah.
It's got to do with Japan. Their bouldering, like, community is crazy. I don't mean crazy and like they go like climb higher things. I mean like the barrier to entry and the level that like the average Japanese boulder is at, a boulderer is at, is supposed to be like so incredibly difficult. Like an average bouldering gym, like a few pros went over to go climb it and they were like, this is madness.
Really?
Like what they considered like an average climb was like absolutely mad. So yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
I feel like when the Japanese do something, they do it.
Yeah, I think it's like one of those things where you choose what you're going to do when you're in like high school, and then that's your thing.
That's it.
Your niche,
yeah.
Your niche.
That's your personality.
Yes. There's a lot of us that probably have got the same personality that they had in high school or secondary school if you're down here from Devon.
Yeah. A little bit. That's just a little bit.
Yeah.
One of the things I looked at in terms of preserving and creating, I guess, tradition, and then they're still produced in this way, I think, is the kimono.
Oh, well, yeah.
Very famous. I was going to say export, but I don't think they export them that much, actually. Very famous product of Japan.
Yeah.
I will probably call it a kimono at some point. And that's because I'm silly and Star Wars has influenced my brain too much. But yes, the kimono. So they started making these around the 8th century, so within the year 700. And I think it just blew my mind, like, how they were able to do that. So I wanted to explore that a little bit. And of course, the first step is getting some silk. And where do they get silk?
The silk worm. Yeah, worms, that's what I said.
Bombyx mori, the Latin for the specific type that they were used, is typically raised on a diet of mulberry leaves. So they were getting the making paper on one end.
Yeah.
And then feeding the rest to the silkworms.
What was the name of that? Oh, the kozu. Kozu leaves.
The rearing process requires careful control of the temperature, humidity, and ventilation to ensure healthy silkworms. And after about a month of feeding, the silkworms are ready to spin their cocoons. Once the cocoons have been created, they are carefully harvested. The cocoons are boiled to kill the silkworms and soften the sericin, which is like a natural gum that holds the silk fibers together. Mm-hmm. So if you're unaware, essentially if you think about like a spider's silk, it's a lot thicker than that, and they'll just kind of wrap it around themselves to build a cocoon like a caterpillar would, but obviously caterpillars don't make it out of silk, so we don't harvest those. Then they degum it, so the reeling, after boiling, the cocoons are unwound to extract the silk threads specifically. That's called reeling, which involves finding the filament's end and carefully pulling it to create a long strand of silk. And obviously, or several filaments are often combined to create a single thread that we twisted together. That process, however, leaves some sericin on the silk, giving it a rough texture. So they have to go through a degumming process, which washes the silk to remove all of this sericin and make it as smooth as possible. Then there are different ways to weave the silk thread into fabric. And depending on which weaving technique you go for will dictate how your kimono looks. Right. So you have the plain weave, which is the simplest form of weaving, where threads are woven over and under in a regular pattern. And that's used to create a lightweight and breathable fabric. And some twill weaving, which creates a diagonal pattern by altering the weave structure. This provides a bit more strength and durability and was the most often used in kimono production. Satin weaves create a smooth and shiny fabric with minimal interruptions in the pattern. It was popular for high-quality kimonos and decorative fabrics. You have the nishiki, or brocade, which is a complex weaving technique involving multiple colours and intricate patterns and requires specialised looms and is often used for formal kimonos and ceremonial garments. And then you had your tapestry weaving, which is suzure, T-S-U-Z-U-R-E. I don't know how they pronounce the T-S in Japan. Obviously, that's a...
T-S, what was it?
U-Z-U-R-E.
Z-U-R-E.
Because T-S is obviously the Western
Sund, it'd be Suzuri.
Suzuri, okay.
Yeah.
And that technique involves Italian. Yeah, unless it's Italian, and then I'll obviously anything that's not English, I just pronounce slightly Italian now.
Yeah, you always do.
Yeah. Involves weaving individual threads to create intricate designs and patterns. It's similar to tapestry weaving in the Western textile world, and that allows for a bit more of an artistic expression. But one of the things I was like, okay, but how are they colouring things back then? Because I knew that we had colours here, but purple was the most difficult colour to get a hold of, because the only place we could find it naturally occurring was in like snails or something. So I had to look at that as well, and it was often come from natural dyes derived from plant, animal, or mineral sources. Indigo derived from the indigo plant, and that produced deep blue hues, and that involved fermenting the indigo leaves to create a vat of dye. Fabric was then dipped into the dye, and then it was oxidized to create its color. So essentially it was just left out to dry. Safflower was used to produce red and pink hues. The dye was extracted from the petals of the safflower, and the fabric is soaked again. Shibori involves in manipulating fabric to create patterns before dyeing, and that includes folding, tying, twisting, and compressing fabric to resist dye in specific areas. So if you think of tie-dye, those sort of techniques were used, but in a much more intricate pattern than what you did when you were five at school. So they had tying, where you would tie parts of a thread together. You would mm-hmm. stitch lines of fabrics together to stop them getting dyed. You could bind fabric together. Stencils were used. Essentially, they would create a paste from rice that they would stick onto the fabric. And then they could, you know, shape that however they wanted, and then dip the garment into the dye. And then when they take it out, wait for it to dry, remove this paste. The dye obviously wasn't where they had stuck that paste. So they did some really, really cool things. And that's just like, 7th century? 8th century, did I say?
Mm-hmm.
It's just wild that that's the kind of stuff that they were doing back then. And something that they've kept up to the modern era, going off your point earlier. Like, kimonos are still made like that.
Yeah.
Of course you have your mass-produced ones as well. But some, you know, super expensive ones are still produced in this way. Just really cool. And just, I think having the time, I think that in a sense shows a developed nation, in the sense that people have time to do that as a craft for a living and spent so much time mastering it, right? So yeah, really cool. Really, really cool. Cool stuff.
Cool stuff.
But yeah, I don't know how I'd look in a kimono.
So you get a lot of people think that like it's just women that get kimonos.
Right.
That is not true. No male kimonos. Not sure if they're called kimonos.
What do you mean, the plural?
No, as in like guys wearing kimonos.
Oh, I see.
Because I'm not sure if there's a name for it. The most common type of men's kimono you'll see is the Montsuki. Oh, it's the Suki, it's the thingy. Yep. Or the Yakata. Yakata? Yeah, kimono or yakata. There's a difference, apparently. I don't know enough to know what the difference is.
No, I'm sure there's like stuff about status and
yes, very much so.
Like your relation to the people whose event you're attending and things like that.
Also family as well.
Family, right? Yeah.
Your family name, where you come from, what presents the family.
Yes, that's true. Have you watched Shogun?
I watched a few episodes of Shogun.
Yeah, I think I'm two or three episodes in, but I've loved it so far.
Yeah, same.
It's been fantastic. Your boy,
Cosmo Jarvis, who
Cosmo.
I will always watch whatever they are in, because I'd be like, local lad down the road.
Yeah.
Saw him fight one of my mates.
Oh, dear.
Absolutely hilarious.
Yeah. Just some great tunes as well. Every so often I come back to Gay Pirates.
Yeah, I was going to say, I do, in my Spotify list, I've got a Cosmo playlist, probably has 10 songs out of all the best of some could say. Sure Is Not Hell, Jesus.
Yeah, I know it.
Gay Pirates. Mel's Song, You Got Your Head on the Wrong Way Around. Love This. As well. Which was filmed in a local church, if you didn't know.
There's a few of his music videos that are like, oh, I know that road.
My Day is filmed on the Timmouth like estuary along the river.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's one of the fields on the right. If you're driving down towards Timmouth from Newton Abbott, it's on the fields on the right.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, it's weird. For us small town folk, you know.
For us small town folk, yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. I don't think people that watched it and know him know his music, because he doesn't get that many like monthly listeners.
No, I guess he hasn't produced anything in a long time, right? But you would expect it to have spiked a little bit.
Yes. Yeah.
Gay
Pirates.
Well, it's still at 34K. But yeah.
Oh, My Strange is a great album.
Oh, well, he did produce something in 2020. I did not see that.
Yeah, he did. It was too weird, like... I think it's just a deluxe edition of all the songs of, like...
Oh, I see.
Because Love This is on it.
Yes.
And so is Friend of the Devil. And Girl From My Village, another one. Because that was the local pub. That's just so funny. He gets kicked out of a local pub, and I'm like, I'm drinking that. Dear me.
Good times. All right. What else? Have you got anything else?
That's it.
That's it for me as well.
I could
really
talk about Japan and anime and manga drawings for years if we wanted to, but we probably shouldn't. It's a science podcast, not.
I guess so. I mean, that is the cultural innovation that they produced. I mean, if we were to go into the actual specifics of animation techniques.
Yes, the science
that
behind
could be,
it.
A bit more scientific, but I didn't think about that until just now, so I don't have any research on it.
That's a shame. Like, the drawing techniques are incredible that they use. There's some like manga that like there's panels, because it's panels. If you imagine like Western style comics, they're called panels, but you have like whole page panels that are just like phenomenal. That so in a mass produced in terms of like it's printed for mass and is made in like a week, that they've put so much effort into some of the art.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Yeah.
All right then. Well, if that's it, I guess we'll cut it a bit shorter there. I guess for us it's actually been longer due to technical difficulty slightly.
Yes.
But yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. Do appreciate it.
Come back again.
I hope you've enjoyed
time.
Japan.
We'll be here.
Maybe we'll take a slight hiatus from the historic side of things now and return to our normal scheduling. So if you have anything that you would like to request, leave a comment. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, whatever it is, at InfoEntropyPod or InformationEntropyPod. You'll be able to find us. Whichever directory you're listening on as well. If you can leave a comment, please do. We appreciate it massively. It helps us out a ton. And if you just want to send us a DM or something because you don't want to do it publicly, absolutely fine as well. Instagram is probably the best place for that. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. All right. Anything else you'd like to tack on the end there?
No.
Okay, cool. Well, that'll do it then.
That's it. Yeah.
Thanks for joining. We'll catch you guys next time.
Now for now.